of the great musician whom they could not see. However, one day, a daring mouse decided to do a little exploration, and he climbed up the piano and returned very thoughtful. Wires, tightly stretched, of graduated length, which trembled and vibrated, were the secret of the music he discovered. The mice had to revise their old beliefs. Only the most current conservative continued to believe in the great musician. And then another exploring mouse discovered the hammers dancing and leaping upon the wires. They became the secret of the music. It was more complicated, but it showed that the world that they lived in was purely mechanical and mathematical. The great musician came to be thought of as a myth by the mice. But the great musician kept on playing. I think that's a pretty accurate description of what we see in our world today. People have all sorts of theories and all sorts of explanations for this, that, and the other thing, and the world in which we live, and why things are happening the way they are. But the great musician keeps on playing. And the music is according to his will and his plan, even though sometimes we can't understand the direction that that music is taking. And I think the sovereignty of God is one great theme that runs through the history of the kings of Israel and Judah. So I'd like to focus on that this evening. And it's already been mentioned a number of times in our prayers. I think the Lord is already playing the music, as it were, this evening. But, you know, the king thing didn't start with Saul. All the way back in the book of Genesis, in chapter 17 and verse 6, God said to Abraham, I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And then God said to Sarah, and I will bless her, and also said to Abraham about Sarah, I will bless her, and will also give you a son by her, and she shall be a mother of nations, kings of peoples shall be from her. Then later God said to Jacob in Genesis chapter 35, verse 11, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply, a nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. Now, in all of these instances, the word that is translated king is the Hebrew word melech, which was the most common word translated king several hundred times. And God is predicting all the way back in the age of the patriarchs that there will be kings someday. Now, there's some controversy as to whether God was referring to the kings of Israel or whether he is referring, for example, to the kings of Edom that are mentioned in Genesis chapter 36. and kings from various other descendants of Jacob and Abraham and Sarah. I don't know. But all the way back then, God was saying there would be kings. Turn to, look at Deuteronomy chapter 17, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and beginning at verse 14. Moses is speaking to the nation of Israel just before he dies and just before Israel enters the promised land. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your brethren. You shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Now back in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob was predicting the future of his son, he said to Judah, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. And the word Shiloh means the one to whom it belongs. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until the one to whom it belongs comes, and to him shall be the gathering of the nations. All the way back in Genesis, God, through the mouth of Jacob, predicts the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, the one to whom all the nations will gather one day and be ruled by him. From beginning to end, God knows the end from the beginning. He is sovereign over all the affairs of men. And he knew 400 years or so before it actually happened that Israel would want a king. That Israel would want to be like everybody else. And so God tells them ahead of time, when that day comes, you may set a king over you according to my specifications, the one that I choose. He has to be one of your brethren. He may not be a foreigner. Verse 16. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, for the Lord has said to you, you shall not return that way again. Horses represented military power. And God says to Israel, I don't want you depending on your own military strengths. I will be your military power when you need it. You look to me for victory. Then he goes on to say, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart be turned away. Wives represented political power. Because in those days, very often, in order to cement political treaties between different nations, a marriage would take place between the king of the one nation and the daughter of the king of another, or something of that sort. Wives represented political power. God says, no treaties with other nations Because if you do that, what will happen to you is what happened to Solomon. Most of his wives were gathered that way. And then thirdly, you shall not multiply silver and gold for yourself. I don't want you depending on economic power. I will provide for you. Verse 18. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book. It was not enough that he have a copy of the law available to him. The king was to write his own copy, make his own copy of the law. You know how it is, don't you? When you take notes on what you read, it tends to stick better. And God wanted his kings to have their own copy in their own handwriting. But that wasn't enough. Verse 19, and it shall be with him wherever he went. The copy of the law was to be with him. It shall be with him. He shall read in it all the days of his life. He was to read God's law every day. Why? That he might learn to fear the Lord his God and be careful to observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, that he may prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Our focus this month is going to be on the divided kingdom. The kingdom of Israel in the north that rebelled against Solomon's son Rehoboam, led by Jeroboam, was ruled by 19 kings before they were carried away into captivity in 722 BC. And God wrote over the title of each of those kings' reigns, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. There wasn't a single good one in the whole bunch. In the southern kingdom of Judah, which lasted approximately 150 years longer than the northern kingdom of Israel, there were 20 kings who had ruled. And over the lives of 8 of those 20 kings, God writes, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. And so you see, because of those 8 kings, what happened? The nation of Judah was preserved, was prolonged in the kingdom. God keeps his promises. So God outlined for Israel, long before kings came onto the scene, the proper conduct for a king. So the kings couldn't get back at God and say, well, you never told me. Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a long chapter. 68 verses. And against a background of the following curses or judgments, if Israel chose to reject God and to disobey his requirements. Listen to some of these curses that God said would come upon his people if they rejected him, if they turned away from him, if they disobeyed him, if they turned to other gods, they would be cursed wherever they went. They would be cursed in whatever they tried to produce from the land. They would be cursed in their children. They'd be cursed in their livestock. They'd be cursed by plague and horrible diseases, by drought and blight. They would be cursed by madness and blindness. They would be unable to enjoy what they owned. They would be cursed by seeing their sons and daughters sold into slavery. They would be cursed by oppression and plundering from surrounding nations. They would be cursed to the point of cannibalism. They would be cursed by deportation and scattering of the in the surrounding nations. Out of those 68 verses, God spends about 15 verses at the beginning of the chapter telling them the wonderful ways that they would be blessed if they kept his commandments. And then the rest of the chapter details, in minute detail, exactly what would happen in Israel if they turned away from God. They had no excuse. They knew what was coming. Jehoram, otherwise known as Joram, king of Israel, experienced a famine in his day that was so bad that women were eating their children. God told them that that would happen. Against that background, this is what God says to Israel. Once again, through Moses, before they entered the promised land, the Lord will bring you and the king whom you set over you to a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known. And there you shall serve other gods, gods of wood and stone. We move on into the book of Judges. And after Gideon's famous victory over the Midianites, 300 over 135,000, the people of Israel are so excited by Gideon and so idolize him that they say to him in Judges chapter 8, verse 22, the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. Gideon said, no thanks. You already have a ruler. His name is the Lord. You don't need me. Now the word used here is the word masal, which means to have dominion over. The word melech that has been used up to this point is a word that simply means to have ultimate authority, king. Here, have dominion over. The people of Israel come to Gideon and say, we want you to have dominion over us. And Gideon says, no, the Lord has dominion over you. Well, you know, one of Abimelech's many sons, Gideon's many sons named Abimelech must have been standing there when he heard his father reject the kingdom. Because when his father died, Abimelech decided that he wanted to be king. And you read his terrible story in Judges chapter 9. Abimelech curries favor with the city of Shechem, in which his mother was born. And as a result, we read in Judges chapter 9, verse 6, all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Milo, and they went and they made Abimelech, Melech, okay, king, beside the terebinth tree that was and the pillar that was in Shechem. And you know what happened in that terrible story? For 3 years, Abimelech ruled, and then he fell out with his supporters, and a civil war started, and the end result was that a woman threw a piece of millstone down from a tower on Abimelech's head and killed him. The whole episode was one horror after another. And that was Israel's first experience with a king which they had set up over themselves. And they didn't learn from it. God is doing everything possible to help his people realize that human kings were not God's will for them. He was their king. But they're not getting it. Later on, Israelites asked Jephthah to come and be commander. Now, that's still a different word, okay? Commander. That was a military term. One who can recruit and organize an army. That this thought of having a human leader, captain, general, king, just keeps recurring and keeps recurring. And as you go through the book of Judges, you find that the nation of Israel's spiritual backbone keeps weakening and weakening and weakening. And at the end of the book of Judges, two times over, we read this. In those days, there was no Melech in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We read that in Judges chapter 17 and again in Judges chapter 21. No king in Israel. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Do you think that was because they didn't have a human king? I don't think so. I don't think that's what that means. I think what that means is they had rejected their heavenly king. They were living as though they had no king. They were living as though they were not under any authority. Everyone doing what was right in his own eye. And then along comes Samuel. And under Samuel, there's a tremendous spiritual revival. But Samuel is only a human being. And he gets old. And his sons do not follow in his pathway, in his way. Samuel chapter 8. Please turn there with me. Verse 4. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, look, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you. They have rejected me, that I should not rule, reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the very day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. You see, what God is saying here is, look, these people have been after a king ever since they left Egypt. Give them what they want. Give them what they want. They're not going to learn any other way. Give them what they want, but before you do, warn them what it's going to be like under a king. So Samuel does that. And as we read through this passage very quickly, take note of a verb that is repeated over and over and over and over again. Verse 10. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots, and he will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, and will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take your male servants and your female servants and your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep and you will be his servants, and you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Pretty obvious, isn't it? Take. That's what human kings do. God stands ready to give. And you are exchanging that kind of a king for this kind? Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, verse 19. And they said, no, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of the king, Lord. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice and make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. So, in the next chapter, chapter 9, God says to Samuel, verse 16, I want you to notice this. Tomorrow, about this time, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him commander over my people Israel. Chapter 10, verse 1. Then Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on Saul's head and kissed him and said, is it not because the Lord has anointed you commander over his inheritance? Now this is a different word. You know what this word is? Very interesting. This word is nogid. I don't know that I pronounced it right, but that's what it is. And it means a prominent and conspicuous one in the eyes of the public. That's what it means. Because you see, that's what Israel wanted. They kept calling him a king. But what they wanted was a prominent and a conspicuous one. And so that's what God calls him. And Saul was prominent and conspicuous. Head and shoulders taller than anybody else in Israel. God gave them exactly what they wanted. And they very quickly tired of him. You don't have to go any further than chapter 13 to find out that they've lost all their faith in him. Chapter 12, Samuel retires. And in his retirement speech, in verse 12, he says this, "And when you saw that Nahash, Melech of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, 'No, but Amalek shall reign over us,' when the Lord your God was your Melech." Then David is anointed, the man after God's own heart. And what happens? Saul, knowing that David is anointed to be the next king, tries to get rid of him. But God prevents it. Then David's son, Solomon, becomes king. And God tells Solomon that his right to rule will last forever, although not his family lasting forever. And then you come to Solomon's bratty son, Rehoboam, who says that my little finger is going to be thicker than my father's thigh. And as a result, the nation splits in two. But God preserves two tribes for David and Solomon's family. And then you come to Joash, whose grandmother sets out to destroy all of David's family. But he has an aunt who hides him in the temple. Good place to hide him. Last place Athaliah would ever go would be to the temple. And little Joash is hidden there from age 2 to age 7. And then he's brought forth. The only remaining son, descendant of David and Solomon. But God is sovereign. And then, of course, you come to Hezekiah. Hezekiah is given 15 extra years to live, and during those 15 years, Manasseh is born. Because Manasseh is only 12 years old when he takes the throne. Once again, God in his sovereign power is preserving David's descendants. And I'm out of time. Jehoiachin, otherwise known as Jeconiah or Kaniah, because of his sin, Jeremiah says, none of your descendants shall ever sit upon the throne of Israel. And he was the descendant of David. Uh-oh, has God blown it finally after all the ins and outs and vagaries and violence and murders and rebellion? And has God lost control? No. No. 400 years later, in a little town in the hills of Galilee, a lowly carpenter and a young woman are betrothed in marriage. the young carpenter, the carpenter, a direct descendant of David's royal line. The young woman, a descendant of David, but not his royal line. Not a descendant of Jehoiachin. And to that young woman is born a son. And Joseph adopts him as his son and passes to Jesus the right to rule. And in Jesus Christ, we have the right to rule and the family of David ruling forever. God is sovereign. Through all, everything that happened during the period of the kings, God was carrying out his music in spite of the opinions of the mice. Who's in charge of our world today? It's the same God. We look at what's going on in our world today and we say, what in the world? You can imagine that people of God back in the time of the kings would look at what was going on in Israel and Judah and say, what in the world is going on here? God is playing his music. And he will bring his composition to a close.